Thank you, Rick, and good afternoon. I'm Susan McGinnis for KUAC-FM Fairbanks. Some weeks ago, I had half an ear on a Phil Donahue show when this piece of information brought me fully alert. In Bolivia, over some period of time, four gentlemen of stature and some influence in their country killed their wives. Their reasons were varied. Here are two of them. One wife had brought her husband's dinner to him later than he had required. Another enrolled in a college course against her husband's will, and yes, without his permission. The Bolivian men were never brought to trial. The courts, and indeed the male population of Bolivia, seemed to agree with the men and their explanation of the murders. It was for each of them a matter of honor. Such disobedience as had been displayed by their wives could not be tolerated. Well, yes, Bolivia is very far away, and its social customs not mirrored in our culture. Or are they? Perhaps subtly, differently, they are. In our own history in the 1860s, according to Massachusetts law, a husband was permitted to, the legal words were, physically chastise his wife, providing that the weapon he used was no thicker than his thumb. It is the law from which we have gained the phrase rule of thumb. If the wife died as a result of his chastisement, the husband would not be held liable. Well, much has changed in the past 140 years, but in some ways, the practice of violence towards women within marital and other intimate relationships has become closeted as society has become less outwardly accepting of it. It still occurs. Today, domestic violence occurs behind closed doors, both victim and victimizer caught in a kind of private hell. Very few people outside the relationship are aware of their true situation, and frequently they are unaware of their own situation and unaware of and wary of the very services which might help them put an end to emotional and physical turmoil and violence. Today, Sunday at Noon takes a very personal look at what we call domestic violence. For the next hour, we'll listen to one woman's story and talk about the ways in which it is not just one woman's story, but the story of many women in Fairbanks, in Alaska, and in the rest of our nation. Good afternoon. As I said, I'm Susan McGinnis. I'd be pleased to introduce you to my guests today. Jennifer, our main guest, was married for 13 years in a relationship which became increasingly trapping and violent. She has come today to talk about her story, both in the interests of talking about domestic violence in general and in the interest of reaching women who may themselves be involved in such relationships. Also with us, Kate Lane, Counselor Coordinator for Women in Crisis Counseling and Assistance here in Fairbanks, and Mary Cooper, also with WICA, the Advocate and Training Coordinator. Good afternoon, ladies, and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Jen, I'm wondering, I'd like to begin with you and begin before this period of violence began in your marriage. I'd like to look back to the time, some 13-plus years ago, when you were getting ready for your marriage and what your expectations were of it.
Well, looking back at it now, it's a little difficult to say what my expectations were since reality hit me in the face so quickly. Actually, I lived with my ex-husband for a year and a half before we ever got married. I had a four-month-old son, which I brought into the relationship, and my then, at the time, boyfriend was very, very good with my son, and I suppose I needed some help, and I saw in him a lot of qualities that I had seen in my father, which I know now that women do, mm-hmm. and I just pictured us in sort of a Walton's relationship, actually. We had a lot of things in common. A lot of things I'm not quite willing to say to a lot of people, but we seem to get along pretty well. And his ideas he expressed about child raising and about where the woman should be in the home sounded feasible to me. They sounded like, yes, this is right, this is where I want to be. Mm-hmm. And at the time I lived with him, I got a few indications that maybe he wasn't going to carry through with all the things that he had been saying, and that maybe he was a little bit violent, since he would get angry at things that would happen at work, and instead of discussing them with me when he came home, he would go right to the refrigerator, get a few beers, and then shove his fist through the wall by my head. That gave me an indication. If I had known then even a little bit about what I know now, I definitely would have gotten out of the relationship at that time instead of being roped into it more and more.
What were your thoughts or feelings or when that would happen? How did you say to yourself, well, this is okay?
When that happened, first of all, I had never experienced any kind of violence at all in my home. I had never even been spanked as a child. My parents never even argued in front of us. So I didn't know what to expect. I knew that out there in the world, other people experienced different things and handled their emotions differently. So I figured, okay, this is how he's handling his emotion. This has happened at work, or this has happened during his day. And as a good wife that I want to be, I am supposed to stand back, watch him shove the fist through the wall, repair the hole afterwards, fix him dinner, and then be there to listen and be supportive. That's what I felt my main duty was. More than just duty, I felt inside that if I wanted to be the wife that I knew he wanted me to be, I had to do these things. I had to be this. I had to be more than just a listener. I had to be everything for him. And so I was trying to make myself be that for him, and I was a buffer. I tried to buffer his feelings and tone down his emotions and help him through this. So I felt that was my role. And increasingly, as he began to see that coming from me and he began to get that from me, if there were times that he didn't get that support from me, then he let it be known that that's what I was supposed to be. So he just reinforced my opinion of that's the way I was supposed to be.
So in some ways you felt all was well with the world. You were balancing for him and buffering for him, and that was all right. And this marriage would be successful as long as that balance remained.
Right. And I felt, even ever increasingly through the years, that's how it became. As long as I did enough, the marriage would be okay. And he recognized that immediately, and I'm sure played right along with it. Maybe he didn't even realize he was playing along with it. I think he did now, looking back at it. But things that would happen when the violence got increasingly worse, and when the put-downs and the insults got worse and worse, and his days would be bad and he would come home, I was expected to balance more and more and more. I was expected to balance work and then come home, balance the children, take care of the house, have dinner ready at precisely 6 o'clock. If it wasn't, it would usually be thrown down or thrown at the wall, or something would be done with it. And I was just expected to handle more and more of his balance in his life. Things that he couldn't handle, I was expected to take over more and more. And he made it pretty clear that the things that happened in his life, if something went wrong in his life, it was my fault, because I had taken on the blame and the guilt for everything that went wrong in his life for so long. He just expected me to continue on doing it. So,
you know, I called this show, when I first started to think how I would characterize it, I called it Living with an Iron Fist, which I think now is a misnomer. But I want to ask you a question in that context. That this did what you've described as what I would call emotional violence, jokes and insults along with physical violence, did it come down like a ton of bricks, or was it something that was more subtle in its creation?
It was very, very subtle. It was subliminal. It was, there's no other way to explain it except, looking back at it now, I get the idea of mass hypnosis, only it wasn't to the masses. It was just so subliminal that, looking back, I never even realized I was being abused. And I'm sure that people, even in the workplace, if they're abused or put down or told that they're less than they are or that they can't do something, that itself is a form of abuse. But we grow to accept that. And I had accepted everything he had been saying for so long that I started accepting more and more when he would tell me that I was no good and I couldn't do these things and I shouldn't be doing this. Even though in my life I was proving to him that I could I could go to work and I could raise a children and I could do this, when he would be upset and tell me that I couldn't, I just accepted it. It was, my self-esteem was at an all-time low, and he just played on that fact that my self-esteem was so low. And he was, I guess it was kind of ruling with an iron fist, because in one instance he would tell me, no, you can't go to school, and then turn around and tell me that it was for my benefit that he wasn't letting me go to school because I couldn't succeed in the school anyway and that I was more needed here. So he played on my emotions and he played on my self-esteem. I don't even know if he really realized that he was abusing. I really think that abuse is kind of relative. He came from a very abusive family. And when I say abusive in forms of his family, that means he has lived through watching his stepfathers hold knives up to his mother's throat and tell the kids they better eat their spaghetti or their mother will be killed. Hmm. You know, things like that. So he's had to live through a lot of violence himself and go through it. So what he thought, and we've talked about it since, what he was doing to me, he never viewed as abuse. He would constantly tell me, what are you so afraid of? What are you crying about? I just hit you. I didn't mean to break your nose, but at least I didn't hold a knife to your throat.
So in his mind, he was restraining, holding back.
He was controlling for my own good, of course. It was always for my own good. Mm-hmm. So he and him as the domineering father figure and the head of the household, he was supposed to keep everyone in check and guide them along in their life. And that's what he was doing. So it was, you know, we all thought it was for our own benefit. And that's why it was so hard to break away and realize, no, it's not for our own benefit. Mm-hmm. This is damaging.
Let me break in just enough to tell people who tuned in late that our subject today is what I've called intimate violence, domestic violence, violence between partners by husband towards wife. My invited guests today are Jennifer, whose story is of a 13-year marriage of which at least 8 years were physically, extremely physically violent. With Jennifer, Mary Cooper, who is the advocate and training coordinator for Women in Crisis, and Kate Lane, counselor coordinator also for WICA. Kate and Mary, as Jennifer has been talking, you've been nodding and taking a note or two. Can I ask for your thoughts, given what Jen has brought us? Mary Cooper.
Okay, so much of what Jennifer is talking about is typical of battered women's experiences. It's almost overwhelming to try to keep track of it all. But when she was talking about hypnosis, emotional violence can be compared to brainwashing. Studies have showed that the same techniques have been used to brainwash people as are used in emotional violence in intimate relationships.
Now, how so? Give me a how this might happen. What happens in brainwashing that is the same as what happens in private violence?
Right. Well, whether the batterer realizes it or not, often it's systematic and it's repeated, so that it's something that builds from one step to another and may start with, like Jennifer said, insults, jokes, something that seemingly harmless that happens in a lot of relationships. Mm. And those insults and jokes are just invasive into someone's self-esteem, into someone's psyche, and the batterer will then add on to those and move into more invasive forms of emotional violence because, as Jennifer also said, violence is about control. And so after a while, maybe the jokes and insults aren't controlling anymore, and it's necessary to move into ignoring someone for long periods of time, depriving them of food or depriving them of sleep, depriving them of support, moving up a scale of abuse.
And this is also emotionally isolating, so that the reality, the woman or child, or in some cases man, is skewed, isolated, barred off from other parts of the world.
That's true. I was continuously isolated. It seems step by step. First, I was isolated from my friends. My friends didn't like to do what we like to do, so I shouldn't be seeing them, and my friends took too much time away from me, from him, actually, and the family.
Your husband was saying this
to
you.
Right, he was saying that to me. And he would point out examples, so it became apparent to me that, yes, I could clean my house better if I had more time to spend on it instead of visiting with my friends during the day. So bit by bit, I began to be cut off from outside interferences, he would call them, from the realization that other people out there didn't live exactly like I lived, which helped to reinforce the degradation and the hypnosis effect. Mm-hmm. And after my friends were alienated, then my family became alienated from me. And he would do that in outward ways. He would start to insult my family, and he would make sure that if they called on the phone, that he would tell them I wasn't there. Whether I was or not. And it became so that my family felt, well, if there's something going on here, then she will come to us and she will let us know if she wants help. Otherwise, she must like it. And my friends felt the same way. So it's a gradual thing, but it does go step by step, level by level. It almost seems very calculating. And it was so subliminal, I didn't really realize what was happening. I just felt that he was trying to make it so that it was just the nucleus of our family, so he could concentrate and I can concentrate on each other and the children. I felt that it was for the best.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting how sacrosanct we hold the family. Mm-hmm. Mother,
right.
Dad, cousins, friends, siblings won't go in and say, Jennifer, is there something wrong? What can we do? And if they do, it's almost your obligation to say, no, everything's fine. We're managing little troubles now and then, right? But we don't interfere.
It's more than just an obligation to say no. It's a habit. Mm-hmm. After a while of this, you start making excuses for the person that is abusing you, partly because you're embarrassed yourself, partly because you don't want your children to feel any backlash, or you don't want your children to start blaming their father for anything. You don't want to upset the balance. You've been trying so hard to keep this equilibrium and balance and be a buffer that you just continue on. You make excuses to everyone. You make excuses if he is too drunk to get up and go to work that day.
Mm-hmm.
You call in sick. You make excuses to his mother because he doesn't want to get on the phone and speak to her. So you say that he's not there. You're just continually making excuses. It becomes so easy to fill in for him, you know.
And denying the abuse is such a strong way to protect yourself, too. So many women fear that if they reach out for help and tell people what's happening in their relationships, it'll lead to an increase in the violence.
If he finds out what I've said.
Right. Mm-hmm. He'll be so angry.
Mm-hmm.
So it's better just to keep it within the family and try to create the balance. Try to stop it myself.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the biggest things we see in the shelter when women are coming in, is the denial of the abuse. You know, they minimize it and they say, well, if I would have gotten the dinner ready at 6 o'clock, like Jennifer was saying, then I wouldn't have been hit, and, well, you know, it was my fault. There's that blame that goes with it, but there's also a real denial that the abuse is that bad. You know, well, it's not so bad. We hear that over and over again, and that's one of the things that happens when women come in, is to kind of cut through that denial and cut through that self-blame.
And is part of that denial because the bruises heal? And because he apologizes or brings flowers or promises or...
Absolutely. That's exactly what's going on. Is, you know, that once the violence is over, they go into the honeymoon stage, which, you know, I'm sorry, it'll never happen again. And I sincerely believe he means it at that time. He really, you know, when Jennifer was saying that he didn't mean to break her nose, you know, that's true. He didn't mean to do that, and he feels bad. But the reality is nothing has changed, and the tension's just going to build up again, and the cycle's going to continue.
Hmm.
I found that I've left 4 times before and gone back every single time. I've now been divorced from him for a year, but it took a lot to make the last time the last time. And the other times that I've gone back, I was always promised that, yes, I will stop. Yes, I will stop drinking, and I will stop smoking, and I will stop doing this and that, and I won't hit you anymore, but you've got to do this, this, and this. And, excuse me, I can stop if you can be better and we can work at it together.
Mm-hmm.
But
So you still had to have the dinner exactly at 6 o'clock or the kids in such and such a line or...
It was always a strings attached. You know, it was always conditional. And so I feel now that he never really took all the full responsibility of his actions. He was still putting it back on me. Mm. Okay, I will do better, but you have to do better also, and we will work at it together. And the honeymoon phase, as Kate was talking about, is very, very real. And that's what we... As women, we want to believe that it's going to be better. We want to believe in human nature and people being able to work through their problems and getting well. We want to believe that things can be better, especially if we work so hard to maintain that balance. And after the honeymoon phase, I felt that when I went back each time, the violence, it got to a breaking point, should I say, faster and faster. Like the first time I left, it took me a good 5 years of being involved in that kind of abuse before I finally left. Then the next time I left, it took me about 2 years. And then the next time after that, it took me 1 year. It was less and less getting up to that point. And I think after the third time I left and came back, I could see very clearly the cycle establishing itself, and I could see that in about every 6 weeks we would have an incident of some type that would result in physical violence to me at least about every 6 weeks.
Jennifer, I don't want to be invasive, but how bad was the violence? What is the physical violence you're describing?
The physical violence started out with him pushing me and screaming in my face, and it escalated to putting pillows over my head and trying to shut me up during the night. And it also was, let's see, I had a lot of sleep deprivation constantly. That was a big part of it. And he just wouldn't let me go to sleep. He would kick me in bed and throw me out of bed, yell at me, insult me, punch me. He was very fond of punching me in the back. Things. Anything, if he'd see me start to fall asleep, then he would make sure I was awake again. And it was also other subtle forms of abuse, like rubbing his back. I would have to rub his back, and if I didn't do it for a full half an hour, I'd have to start all over again. But I was supposed to do that because I was being a good wife when I did it. And then it was every single night I'd have to go, you know, from step A to step B, clear down to the feet, and I would have to do that. And if I didn't, then I could be assured I wouldn't get a good night's sleep that night. And I've had all sorts of things happen to me. I've had food thrown at me. I've had knives held to my face. I've been pushed in front of the children and knocked down. I've had my nose broken in front of both my children. He punched me right in the nose one night, actually, and just splattered. The blood was everywhere. I grabbed my children, ran out the door, and went to my neighbor's house and called my family, and they came and got me. I've had loaded guns held to my head. Shotguns. He's very fond of shotguns. And the children told that he was protecting them, and that's why. And their mother was crazy, and that he was just scaring me and telling me, you know, setting me straight. Well, loaded guns are pretty scary, and he has done numerous times. He has broken glasses. He's ripped clothing off of me, thrown me to the floor, taken my head, and once he chased me outside. Well, a couple times, actually. He chased me outside, knocked me down on the gravel in the driveway, bashed my head into the gravel for a while. Many times he's knocked me upside my head with his fist so hard that it would just be ringing. I've had repeated problems now. He messed up my inner ear, and it can't be repaired because of repeated blows to the side of my head. I've got a cracked tooth that can't be repaired because of being hit in the jaw. My nose is, as you can see, Susan, is a little crooked. That couldn't be fixed. And
Jennifer, you say this all very calmly.
Well, it's a matter of fact now that I feel good to be living through it and being able to tell someone about it. You never think that it's going to get to this point, ever. And when it does happen, each time that it happens, you still feel so guilty. You know, there's that element of guilt there. And you still feel like, well, maybe if you had done something a little differently, or you hadn't done what he said, you wouldn't have gotten it. Whether you deserved it or not, you wouldn't have gotten it. You know, there's always that element of guilt there.
Caitlin, both you and Mary are nodding. What's going through your mind, Kate?
Oh, I was just thinking how many of these stories that I do hear about the violence escalating and escalating to the point where it's so severe people are just shocked. You know, how can you live with that? And I was also thinking the underlying emotional and psychological abuse that Jennifer went through, you know, that kept her hooked in there. And that cycle is real. It just grabs people and they get hooked and they keep thinking it's going to change and it's going to change and okay, all right, this time I'll do everything different. And so she tries all these new things and every time it doesn't work. And so she leaves the relationship and all the hardships of doing that.
Mary Cooper?
I was thinking a lot about the reasons why women stay in abusive relationships, that guilt trap, that if only I did things better. And you pile that on top of things, the messages that you're no good, you can't make it without me, you can't do it alone, and factor into that the children and how it'll affect them, and then throw in your family and how they might be feeling about it, and your own embarrassment about, I chose to trust someone who did this to me. It's hard to face that my judgment may not be good, and that's the message women get, that there was something wrong with your judgment that you chose this person. There are some really powerful reasons why women stay in abusive relationships, and it's not that they like the violence. It's not that that's okay with them.
Let's look at the other side of this coin for a minute. What we're talking about here in your ex-husband, it seems to me, from what you're telling me, is not an ogre, is not a maniac, is not a homicidal perversion on the face of the earth.
So far.
an unexpected reply. I'm just going to ask this open to the table, and Jennifer, you can respond from your experience, or Kate or Mary, yours. What is your sense of, rather than why a woman stays, of which we have some grasp, why does a man abuse a woman? Somebody. Kate, I'm looking at you.
Okay. Well, I think there's a lot of factors that go into that. Frequently what we see is that the man has been abused as a child and kind of carries some of that expectations into the relationship of this is how you interact in an intimate relationship. When, you know, your wife doesn't do what you want, you hit her. So often we see that, but, you know, not always. Frequently, I think it has a lot to do with societal norms of sexual stereotyping. This man is in control, and he's the, I think Jennifer referred to him as the father. You know, he's going to tell her what to do. And when that doesn't work, he gets frustrated. These men tend to have low self-esteem. They feel real inadequate, and a slap or a pinch or a shove brings the woman in line. And then what happens is they start out on the lower end of the physical spectrum, you know, maybe restraining the woman. I don't know how many times I hear that. Well, he restrained me, or he held me back, or wouldn't let me leave, these kind of things. And then they escalate, and he wants to get her attention, so he uses a pinch or a shove, and it goes on. And again, I think it comes from a real insecurity, low self-esteem. You know, I need to get this from her. Difficulties dealing with anger is real frequent. You know, just they explode. And often the home is the only place where this happens. Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde personalities, I mean dual personalities, it seems like. I remember one woman telling me about her drive up to the Alcan with her partner, and he was slapping her and screaming and yelling and very violent. They'd stop at a gas station and he'd hop out and, oh, hello, how are you? You know, just polite as could be. And she'd think, oh, good. You know, he's calmed down now. It's going to be okay. They'd get in the car 5 miles out of town. He'd start slapping her again. You know, it was just this kind of like, he can turn it off. And I think that's, you know, I want to comment on that real quickly, too, that a lot of times what we see happening is these men are such good con artists out in the general public. And so mental health practitioners say, well, he's so nice, you know. Mm-hmm. You must be doing something to cause the abuse. Mm-hmm. You know? And a lot of times these battered women have been so battered that they're incapable of really being articulate or expressing themselves. Or like Jennifer to come here today and talk shows just, you know, she's come a long ways, because a lot of times the women, their self-esteem is so low. So a lot of people hook into.
Right.
Go ahead.
Sorry. Well, two, they start to question themselves. Everyone else thinks he's such a nice guy. What is it about me that he is so violent towards me? So it just feeds everything that's happening.
And is the answer here that Jennifer, the wife, is safe, whereas he cannot yell back at the boss or whomever else might have messed with his day, but when he comes home and the doors are closed, he is free to kick the dog, chase the kids, or beat his wife?
That's true. He used to tell me all the time that he is the king in his own castle, and here he can do whatever he wants to when he's in the home. It didn't register then, but now that it does, then indeed that was what was happening. Everything that happened during his day, if he had any gripe about anything, it would come back, and he felt safe with me in knowing that perhaps that I wasn't going to leave, or in knowing that he could insult me and get it out. Instead of going out and hitting a tree or something, he would come in and vent to me, because he had been telling me all along that's what I was there for. Mm-hmm. So that's what I became there for.
Is there a fear of intimacy, of being able to come home and say, Jennifer, I had a dreadful day. I just need somebody to talk to. I mean, is that something that's real scary?
I think it is pretty scary. He has to present such a macho attitude and such, I hate to use that phrase, but to be such a strong person everywhere. He has to go out and face the world every day. And then when he comes back home, it's hard to give up that attitude of, oh, yes. Yeah. And he can't, I feel that he couldn't let down his guard to me in any way. He couldn't tell me that he felt scared about something or he felt upset about something. It just all came out in anger. All the basic primal feelings and emotions he was having just came out in one lump anger, and it was always directed at me.
Whereas the other emotions that might have been operating might have been uncertainty or grieving or sadness or concern, fear, or...
Right. They were all masked, but he couldn't communicate that to me, because to do that would show some weakness in him or some quality that he didn't want anyone else to know. So he had to be strong. He had to go out there and face another day. So I had to be strong enough to take it from him and help him deal with it. And my ex-husband did live through a lot of violence, but so did his two brothers, and so did his sister. And I know there's a high percentage of children coming out of violent relationships and continuing on the cycle of violence. I understand that. But, you know, there is hope. Other people you don't have to carry it on. You can break the cycle. His sister is not violent with her children and wouldn't tolerate anyone around her being that way. One of his brothers is very, very good with his children, is never, hardly even yells at his wife, has learned to counteract that and to break that cycle. His other brother is not married, but as far as I know in his relationships, he hasn't been that way. So this is one person out of four, you know, that is carrying on the cycle. That's scary in itself. I don't even know if that's as high as the statistics, but I fear for my children now. I have two children, a son that's 14 and a daughter that's 11. And I'm afraid that the messages my daughter has been given all this time by her father and by me putting up with it for so long is that, yes, dear, this is what you do. This is how a good wife is. And now the messages she's getting is that mommy must not be a good wife because mommy couldn't take it anymore. Mommy wasn't strong enough. And my son is getting the messages of, yes, this is how you treat, this is how you keep control of your family. This is how the family stays together. This is how you keep the nucleus. You know, you have to be in control all the time. And so my son's getting messages that he can't be out of control anywhere in his life. And that's really, really hard for a 14-year-old going through puberty to face, that, oh, my God, I can't have uncertainties. Oh, my God, I can't be afraid. You know, I can't have a bad day at school. You know, and what happens if he does? Then he comes home and punches a wall. You know, what does he do? So he hasn't gotten any good messages from his father or me very much, you know, because... It's real hard for the children. That's what I mostly work on now.
We're talking today to Jennifer, who for 13 years was married, is no longer. For at least 8 of those years, her relationship was quite violent. by her husband's hand. Also with Kate Lane, who is a counselor coordinator with Women in Crisis Counseling and Assistance, and with Mary Cooper, advocate and training coordinator also for WICCA. I'm Susan McGinnis, your host. This question about the effect on children, Kate or Mary, I want to turn to you. Is domestic violence a generational problem? Does it move from generation to generation? Mary Cooper?
Yes, there is definitely a generational cycle of domestic violence. And like Jennifer said, it's really important to point out that it doesn't happen to all people. The cycle can be interrupted. One thing I wanted to bring out is that a lot of times we're asked, well, aren't batterers mentally ill? Isn't there some kind of illness that needs to be treated? Battering is a learned behavior, and other behaviors can be learned instead. So rather than using battering to control someone or to deal with anger, a person can learn other behaviors. So that's a big part of what the battered women's movement has been working towards interrupting the generational cycle, helping children to learn that what happened in their families isn't the norm and it doesn't have to continue.
And there are sets of skills with which they might operate?
Oh, absolutely, yes. And a large part of what Women in Crisis does is simply that education. And we're spending a lot of time with students in schools talking about preventing abuse in relationships, refusal skills, dealing with anger, assertiveness skills, all those kinds of basic, like you said, skills.
Don't those skills depend on a good sense of self-esteem? Trust in self? I mean, if I'm going to be assertive, I must have something in my persona that I value enough to assert. Kate Lane?
I think that's real true, and yet I think that as you begin to practice some of those skills, you start to build up your self-esteem.
Right.
Oh, when I say no to someone and they respect that, I can do that.
That gives me a good feeling.
Yeah, it gives me a good feeling to be able to say no. So I think it ties in hand, and you can't have the chicken before the egg. I mean, it's you've got to do them both. You've got to help them learn these skills so their self-esteem can be brought up, so that they'll do the skills, so that, you know, and it just builds on each other. And it's a real just as the negative cycle builds down, the positive cycle builds up, and so it's real important to be doing that. I wanted to comment a little bit on the effects on children. Mary was talking about how important it is to educate children and whatever. I wanted to comment, too, on how kids, when they see violence happening in their home, while they themselves may not be recipients of the violence, they're really affected by mom getting hit by dad, you know. Even if they're not even in the same room, I mean, you know, they can feel the tension in the air. They can sense what's happening. Frequently, and a violent outburst will start because of something that the kids did. You know, they spilled milk on the table, and dad was already frustrated because he came home and it was a rough day, and so he sees the milk gets spilled, he starts screaming about the kids, you know, and next thing you know, mom's getting hit. The kid feels like, oh, if I went to spilled milk, this wouldn't happen. So kids are real affected, and I just want to really stress that violence in a home, whether, women come in and say, you know, he never hit the kids, that's why I stayed, and often they come in when he does hit the kids, you know, it's like that was the final straw. But frequently they'll come in and say, he never hit him, he was a good father. And then when we start talking about, yeah, he was a good father, but the kids are affected by the violence.
Right. The mere fact that they're witnessing violence towards mom is emotional abuse.
Of the child.
Right.
We hear so frequently that in cases of divorce, youngsters from very young to teenagers will assume mom and dad divorced because of something the child, did. Jennifer, what you talked about leaving four times before you finally said, okay, enough.
Yes.
I will not do this. Can you trace the evolution of your thinking, feeling, change? How did you finally say okay? Or how did that process start and follow?
Well, it started when I was in the relationship for about 5 years, and I decided I had had enough, and my husband's drinking was not getting any better. He wasn't stopping his drinking. I realized at that point he wasn't stopping, and he wasn't doing it for us. I thought he had to do it for us, and he didn't want to. So I also thought at that time that my leaving and taking the children was going to show him. It was going to show him something, that we weren't going to stand up for this. And the first time I left, I truly wanted him to come running to me and tell me everything would be better and to make it all better. That's what I wanted to hear, which is exactly what he did. And he told me that he would go to AA meetings and that he would get help for his violence. And I left and stayed away, I think, a week that time. And I figured that a week away was enough of a shock for him to finally get it together and do what it was that he should do to make our family whole again. I was expecting him to make it all better. Mm-hmm. Yet at the same time, he kept telling me that it was up to me to make it better. So I went back knowing this. And then I told myself, okay, I'll try, I'll make it better. And then the cycle of violence repeated itself. It got, in fact, more frequent and worse violence. And then when I started having my clothes ripped off and my glasses broken and bruises on my body that I couldn't explain, then I left again because my family was starting to wonder. And they kept saying, look, you know, there's something going on here. If you won't help us, or if you won't let us help you with it, then at least get away and get somewhere where you can look at it. And so I did. I left for 2 weeks that time. And then...
And was your aim at that point reflection, as your parents advised?
My aim was at that point reflection. And it was also even more of a, look, you know, I can get away. I'm going to do this time. You better do something. It was even more of a statement mm-hmm. to my ex-husband that he had better do something this time. So it was still expecting him to do something. And he came through again. He told me that he would indeed go to the Alcoholics Anonymous. He went, I think, to 3 meetings that time. I even went to one of them with him. We started seeing a marriage counselor. He didn't attack what I felt was his main problem right away. He still beat around the bush. He still looked at it as being our problem. The marriage was our problem, and we had these problems together to work out. So we went to a marriage counselor instead of him going to like an Alternatives to Violence program or a counselor himself in dealing with his anger or to an alcohol rehabilitation program or something. Mm-hmm. He still looked at it as our problem. So we dealt with it in that way. And I went back to him and we continued seeing a marriage counselor until he decided that $60 a session was just too much. And I think that lasted about 4 times. And the marriage counselor at that time was bringing the children in and talking to the children. And he was finding out that maybe there was more here going on than what my husband was willing to say in the sessions. So I think that scared my husband a little bit, and we stopped going. And I stayed. And then the third time, after the violence got worse and worse, and I was having loaded guns held to my head, and his family was becoming aware of the situation, then I was trying outside help on my own, but still staying in the situation. I would go to the church down the road to my minister, and I was talking at length to my minister and the minister's wife, and I was getting messages from them that, yes, this is what you should do, trust in God, and it will be okay, it'll take care of itself, it'll be all right as long as you have enough faith and trust, and yes, persevere, and things will be okay, mainly, if you have enough faith, it'll be all right.
But honor the marriage contract. But,
right, stay in the marriage contract because that's what you signed up for, and darn it, you better stick it out because till death do you part, and that's the way it is. So I was getting those messages, and that was supposed to be my support. Mm-hmm. You know, that's the only place I could look for support, according mm-hmm. to my husband, because I'm sure he knew that that's the message I would get. And
by that time, former friends were out of the picture. And
they were out of the picture, definitely. They were all alienated, and they would... If I felt like I could go to them, they would still give me the same message. They would say, look, you know, you've been going at this for a long time now. Don't you think you just better get away from it before you're killed? And I didn't want to hear that. I still wanted to hear, it's going to be okay, we can make it. Because when I entered into the marriage, I really felt it was for life. Mm-hmm. And I was still operating on that pretense that it was going to be for life. I didn't realize that life might have meant a little bit shorter than what I was hoping for if I stayed in the relationship. And then the fourth time I left, I finally figured out, I had gone to a few Al-Anon meetings myself, and I finally started figuring out that my behavior patterns And my low self-esteem was feeding into his problems. And I finally started figuring out that that I wasn't the cause of his problems. I think that's where it finally hit bottom for me. I wasn't the cause, and I was not going to be the cure. He wasn't going to do it for me. He may never do it, or he may do it next week, you know, but it's not going to be for me. And that gave me a feeling of hopelessness, yet it also released a feeling of exhilaration to know that I wasn't the cause and I wasn't the cure. And that finally broke the straw. When I left the fourth time, I didn't do it in a fit of violence. I didn't run out. Mm-hmm. I planned it. In fact, I told him for weeks before I left, I was leaving by such and such date. I was going, and there was nothing he could do because I finally felt inside that there was nothing else that could be done. We had tried so much. We had tried every avenue, I felt. The marriage counseling, the ministers, every avenue that was out there and available, and we had tried together, but it wasn't a together problem. It was becoming a family issue and a family problem, but his problems weren't my problems. I stopped taking the responsibility for his problem, finally, and started concentrating on what I knew I had to do to better myself and my children.
That was a transformation for you. Each of the other times you have said, I left to bring him alert,
right,
to wake him up,
mm-hmm,
to tell him that I will come back, but this must change.
Right.
This time you left because you couldn't do that. That was not within your realm of power. Is that accurate?
That's true. Before, it was always conditional. I felt like I was wielding a certain amount of power in the relationship. And this last time, I felt like I didn't want to have that power. It's not my responsibility to have that power. I shouldn't have that kind of power over anybody. And it obviously wasn't working anyway to feel that I had that. And so this time it was an unconditional leaving. It was just, I have to do this for myself. That's the way it is. Good luck. And that's how I view it now.
Jennifer, for so many women, no matter how threatening or dangerous or distressing on one level or the other the marriage may be, being out in the world on their own, with or without their children, is like being in a jungle for the first time. It's frightening. Was that the case for you?
It was very, very frightening. In fact, if Women in Crisis wasn't here in this town, I don't think I would be out yet. Or if I were out, it wouldn't be near as easy a transition for me. I relied heavily on the counseling services available. I still do very heavily on the counseling. You need the constant support. You need somebody there telling you that it's okay, that what you're doing is all right, that you are a person, you are valuable, you can succeed. And it was very scary. I had always controlled all the money in the relationship, yet when I got out, I found I didn't have any of the money. Even though I had the control of it, it wasn't mine. So that was a problem. Housing was a problem. All of it was a problem, but I finally realized that what I was facing by going back into it was more of a problem. And I would rather face anything than continue on and keep the cycle going, because at least I was alive and at least I was out, at least I was able to take care of myself. And it came. I'm going to school now. I'm continuing on my nursing degree, which my ex-husband told me I wouldn't be any good at. I wanted to go to school at the beginning of our relationship to continue my education, and he told me I would be a much better hairdresser than a nurse because I couldn't cope being a nurse. So I became a hairdresser, and I'm a very good hairdresser. Now I'm going to be a very good nurse. And it's just those little things that really help you to realize that even though sometimes it's real hard and you run out of money at the end of the month and you have to rely on services around town that you might not want to rely on, like the government and welfare and help, that it's okay to do that. It's all right. You're going to be something, and you're going to be someone, and you are someone, and you deserve it.
Mm-hmm. I have again been watching nods around the table and want to check in to Kate and to Mary, each of your thinking, to remind our audience. We are talking today about intimate violence within a marriage. Our main guest, Jennifer, has brought I think, both courage and an incredible honesty and articulateness to this discussion, and I thank you for that for the remainder of this hour.
Thank you.
As well as what's passed. Kate Lane, again, is the Counselor Coordinator with Women in Crisis here in Fairbanks. Mary Cooper, Advocate and Training Coordinator with the same organization. Jennifer has covered some territory in the past few minutes. I'm just wondering again to check in with each of you who deal with the problem of domestic violence and other violences within the family professionally. I mean, that is your life work for the past several years, and Kate, probably nearly a decade for you, is it not? Your thoughts from a professional perspective on what Jennifer has endured and extricated herself from. Kate.
I think Jennifer's story is real typical of what battered women go through. You know, the escalation of the violence and the escalation of the emotional, psychological abuse and the being hooked into staying. One thing she talked about that I want to comment on was, you know, the alcohol abuse that was going on too. And alcohol abuse often is going on at the same time as domestic violence, as battering is occurring. But it's not a, like a cause-effect relationship. They don't drink so they can batter, and they don't batter because they drink. The relationship is difficult to exactly describe, but it's just real interwoven. And what we really feel strongly about is that you need to address both problems. Jennifer's husband needs to get alcohol treatment, and he needs to look at the issue of his violence and the way he controls his anger, the way he deals with his anger. I also want to comment on the fact that men can change, and I know that what we're saying here is, in Jennifer's case, he didn't. He refused to. She kept trying and hoping and wishing he would change and going back thinking he would, and he made a lot of promises, but he didn't follow through on. But I guess I want to, you know, and a little hopefully, that we see a lot of men who do change and a lot of relationships that can be rebuilt, and that does happen. I think it's important for both the women and the men to get some help, to get some counseling, and to deal with those issues.
And lest someone in the audience think we are leaving the impression that, a battering man is bestial at core, these changes you talk about must be tremendously straining for a man, frightening, new territory not covered, if, as Jennifer relates of her husband, he was raised in a household where violence was the norm, as was my father. My grandfather was extremely violent. Learning your way out of that into a new set of behaviors, a new relationship which may be equal with your wife or lover, must be very frightening. Makes you vulnerable. Makes you have to admit that maybe you're not the man you thought you were, I say with quotes around those words. Hard for a fellow to do, eh?
Yeah. Jennifer talked a while back about her ex-husband's feeling that he ruled within their household and that was his role. There are a lot of messages in our culture that reinforce that, and particularly in the mid-70s, late-70s, it was only that recently that domestic violence was recognized as a crime, that anything beyond just coming in and chatting with the man until he cooled down was done by law enforcement.
It's a private matter.
Right. It was something you just needed to cool down, take a walk around the block, and everything will be okay.
I don't hesitate to take us back to 1860, with which I began this show, when it was codified in law, and Massachusetts did lead the nation in that rule of thumb law. Very slow progression we make as a nation towards a different set of values regarding men and women and how they shall exist together. We have about 5-7 minutes left in our hour. Jennifer, I want to check with you. This might be the wrong question to ask, but I think you must have spent some time thinking about other women who are in battering emotional or physical relationships. If someone is in our audience who is being or has been battered in one or the other of those ways, do you have thoughts for her?
I have a lot of thoughts for anyone out in the audience, children, women, even men who may be emotionally abused. I think it's important to recognize that it happens a lot, and it may be so subtle that you don't know that it's happening, maybe just to sit back and evaluate where you are right now at this time and take a little bit of a look at the people and the relationships that you're in, the people that interact with you every day, and if you're in a marriage or a loving relationship with someone, just take a look and see if it's pretty balanced, or see if you have to do a lot of the giving, a lot more than what you're receiving, and see if any of these things key in. If you get put down a lot, or you seem to be stopped from doing things or completing any dreams you might have, or if you seem to be just in general intimidated in mm-hmm. any way, that's a very subtle form of abuse. I have thoughts that when I first went to Wicca, actually, and began therapy groups there, I thought that this was only happening to me because I was isolated from everyone. I thought, oh my God, I must have done something really terrible to deserve this mm-hmm. kind of treatment. I now know that it's not just me, and a lot of people go through this. I just want someone out there who might be listening, if something like this is happening to them, to know that there is help through the community, and that it's not just them it's happening to, and that they may have a low self-esteem about what has happened, but they didn't cause anything to deserve being treated the way they are. They didn't do enough ever to be hit. And that there's help out there available, and there's hope, and you can work yourself through it. And once you do get through it, believe it or not, you will, in your everyday life, you'll recognize abuse immediately. I mean, before, I hardly realized it was happening to me, and now if someone says something degrading to me, I rise right up to it because I know I don't have to put up with that. I know that that's not the way it is, and I can recognize it immediately. And I think that that helps a lot in your self-esteem and your growth, and just to continue growing and get out there and get the help that you might need. Realize that it's not just you. There's help for you.
Thank you. Concluding thoughts from each of my other guests. First of all, you both have laughed at something that isn't particularly amusing. This is not a laugh of amusement. This is a laugh of something else. Kate, what? I mean, I hate to pin you down. I'm going to.
I guess I'm just Jennifer's change in the last, 5 years since I've known her, 6 years, it is amazing and astounding. And for her to be here today and just saying, right, I'm not going to put up with this anymore. Uh-huh. It felt great. I wanted to give a cheer. And it's, not funny. The topic isn't funny, but seeing people's growth and there's joy and wonder in the whole thing.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mary? I wanted the tape with the crowd noises to go on, you know? And the crowd goes wild. That's where my laughter came from. Yeah, it's just...
You have to retain a certain sense of humor. You have to. That's very vital to get through it all.
And it, too, is just such a powerful feeling to sit here and talk with someone like Jennifer and hear her story. And like Kate said, know where she's come from and where she is today. And to recognize how much she can do to help other people and how much she's already done to help herself. That's so, so wonderful a feeling.
Ah, gee.
Ladies, I want to thank you very much. Kate Lane with Women in Crisis, Mary Cooper with Women in Crisis, Jennifer with yourself, quite surely, I can say. I'm Susan McInnes. This has been Sunday at Noon on KUAC-FM. I want to invite you to join us next week. Longtime listeners will remember that periodically I bring up what is called Alaska's Living History. The College of Liberal Arts here at the University of Alaska Fairbanks honors one or two ladies or gentlemen a year for their contributions to Alaska's living history. Margaret Murray, ecologist, was one from last fall. Governor Hammond, of course, was here. Bob Atwood, who owns and publishes the Anchorage Times, and Walter Hickel, who former director of the Department of Interior. You can tell I'm working by the seat of my pants here trying to remember all of this. Each of these people has been guest on this show, and I've been honored to talk with them. Well, next week, a less well-known figure, but I think you will find this gentleman quite fascinating. George Sundberg is a journalist. He came up to Alaska in 1936 and became involved in the newspapers of our state, He was the editor of the Fairbanks Daily News Miner, also the editor of the Juno Independent for a time. He worked very closely with Ernest Greening, who was very much involved with the statehood issue for the state of Alaska, involved in the territorial government, became the first senator from the state of Alaska to Washington. And George Sundberg went with him in Juneau, to Juneau, and then to Washington, D.C. He has written a number of books. I find him a very interesting man on paper. I'm looking forward to meeting him this week, and I hope you will look forward to meeting him next Sunday at noon. Thanks very much. I'm Susan McInnes for KUAC-FM. My engineer, good job, John Christopite. Thanks a lot.